think we're supposed to start talking now.
Okay, it's Sunday, it's noon, and this is the main course on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Katie Kiefer.
I'm Patrick Martins. I mean, it's pretty safe to say for most Americans, if it's Sunday, it's the main course. It's a real household word. It's a lot of responsibility being
it
a household
is.
Word.
Absolutely, I'm telling you, and it's growing every day.
We've actually really done our job today in honor of the Fancy Food Show, which happens, I think, three cities every year.
That's right, New York, San Francisco, and
Chicago.
I guess Chicago, yeah.
And I've been to all three. They're really cool. New York is, of course, by far and away the biggest show.
It's like 2,300 retailers?
Wow.
Something like that. It's huge. If you've never been, if you buy your tickets in advance, it's not very expensive, and it's a really interesting experience to see.
The whole Jacob Javits Center.
Yeah, it's the whole Javits Center, and it's every possible food product or byproduct you could imagine.
It's really unbelievable.
And lots of samples.
And not only for the people that have stands, like Italy has a stand. The state of Virginia has like
Absolutely.
20 stands, all that. And then, but it's just the sheer amount of people that flock to New York for the big show, you know. So we have a lot of guests as a result.
We do. We have some really interesting people coming on today. Some of them will be in studio with us and some of them will be on the phone. We're going to lead off today with Ron Tanner.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ron Tanner is vice president of communications, government relations, you name it, he does it. He is head of the NASFT, I mean, vice president of the NASFT, and that is the organization that brings us the Fancy Food Show. So I thought it was appropriate to get his take on it, and then we follow him with people who are exhibitors at the show.
Or big visitors who are using the show as a big, you know, moment in their lives. So we have Hugo, who is the one of the main people at the largest beef producer in Chile, which is completely grass-fed. I mean, that's their whole program down there. I mean, just because of where they are, and also because of the natural barriers of the oceans and the mountains, no livestock disease has ever hit that part of the world.
Amazing.
Same with their wine. You know, I mean, nothing has ever penetrated all that. So as a result, they can do things like sell bone-in ribeyes where every other country has to debone them, you know, because, I mean, not in the States, I don't think. But anyway, they're able to get away with certain things.
Well, they could probably sell offal, which we cannot do here.
And marrow and maybe some
exactly,
other thing.
Yeah, exactly, because they feed them grass. They don't feed them animal byproducts.
And for those, we will be doing, we will not be doing translation for Hugo, but he does speak some English, so that'll be exciting.
Yeah.
We'll be doing sign language here.
Yeah, my Spanish is not that great. Maybe he speaks French, though.
No, es bueno. You're being modest. And then we have, who are the people from Rogue Creamery? That was exciting.
We have David, I've forgotten his last name. You'll have to forgive me, but we'll find out. And David is not only one of the cheesemakers at Rogue Creamery, but he's also head of the American Cheese Association, which is, I didn't realize when I invited him onto the show. So I really feel like I drew the ace of cards there. So thank you, Patrick. So he's going to come on. He's going to talk about the dairy industry, making cheese in America. I personally, being a cheeseaholic, want to know why cheese is so freaking expensive now. Mm-hmm. Like, I can buy cheese from Italy cheaper than I can buy cheese from America. I don't like that. That's not fair.
It's weird.
And then we have Fritzy Cohen coming.
Interesting lady.
Fantastic lady. An innkeeper, an oyster grower.
Activist.
An activist, a potato chip person. I mean, she just does so many different things. She's going to be really fun to chat
with. It would
actually
be easier to just say, what doesn't Fritzy do?
Yeah.
And list that.
That's right. And we also have the fabulous Sam Edwards here from...
No, wait a second.
Yeah, there we go. A major, major round of applause for
Sam. He's a big funder. He had a huge article in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
He has partnered with all these distributors here in New York. So, I mean, his things are going to be really easy to find.
And he's premiering a new product called Suriano Ham.
400 days in the making. It is a prosciutto that does truly rival that of San Daniele and Parma and Serrano. I mean, it is that good. And it's done in the American style. And by the way, local to New York. I mean, 400 miles away.
No kidding.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, that is really cool.
Talk about respecting terroir and all that. Uh-huh. Like, better to relieve those terroirs of San Daniele and Parma and start pursuing American versions of
absolutely
those
rock on Sam Edwards.
So we are going to, I guess, bring on Ron. Ron is on the line, or we're going to take a break. All right, by the way, we are produced by Jack Inslee and engineered by Nathaniel Wiener. On the main course, I'm Patrick Martins.
I'm Katie Kiefer. This is Heritage Radio Network, and we are sponsored today by TechServe. And we have Ron Tanner on the phone with us from the Fancy Food Show. Ron, you there?
I'm here, yes. Thanks for having me on the phone.
Oh, my God. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day today. I know you must be like crazy busy, and I really, really appreciate your participation. So,
yeah, it's awesome.
Let's start right away with, you know, tell our listeners a little bit about NASFT, and then we'll go from there.
Okay, great. The NASFT is the Association for Specialty Food Producers in the United States, but also internationally. We have about 3,000 members who make all kinds of food products. We've got people who are making fudge in Brooklyn and people who are bringing in pasta from Italy, people bringing in tea from Sri Lanka. So we've got absolutely almost any type of food you could think of is part of our membership and also here at the Fancy Food Show.
How many vendors do you have? About, is it like, I think it's about like 2,300 people are exhibiting or something. Is that what I saw on the website?
The number of exhibitors at the Fancy Food Show is 2,300.
Wow.
So that's 1,500
wow.
U.S. companies and about 800 international companies.
Fantastic.
That are exhibiting. There's 72 international pavilions here. So I'm actually sitting in an office here. I'm overlooking Turkey, Morocco, Brazil, Mexico. Mm. And in the distance, I think I see Peru and Germany.
That's fantastic.
It's like one of those New York cartoons, you know, where it shows 57th Street, China, and like
that's right, the West Coast, and then China, exactly.
Right.
So, Ron, tell us what makes a fancy food.
How do you define the specialty foods? Like, what are your, you know, requirements to qualify to be in your show?
Well, specialty foods are really products which are made in an artisanal manner or which have exotic flavors or ingredients. So they're basically types of foods which are not mass market foods. They're made, you know, often made by a, you know, an entrepreneur who cares about the food, you know, who really pays a lot of attention to the quality of it. There's also a lot of regional foods that are part of specialty foods. So if you take a mole sauce from New Mexico and sell it in New York, it's a specialty food, whereas down there it may be something people have all the time. There's a lot of regionality to the different foods that are here.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. And I wanted to ask, like, what's hot at the show this year? Like, if people haven't been to the show, or, you know, if they want to know what they missed and come next year, like, what's hot at the show? And is there a theme of shows? Like, do trends develop with the show and all that? Like, how would you define this year's?
Well, yeah, trends develop tremendously at the Fancy Food Show because these are people who are coming up with great food ideas. They're often chefs or entrepreneurs, so they come up with things really, really quickly. So some of the trends we're seeing this year is we're seeing a lot of really high-end chocolates and a lot of those being sold in smaller sizes so people can kind of get their chocolate fix or get their cheese fix or get their you know, potato chip fix or whatever it is in a smaller package, which means that it really costs less for them and is probably healthier for them because there's fewer calories. So we're seeing a lot of that happening and a lot of, you know, unusual combinations. We've got Earl Grey dark chocolates here. We've got a maple bacon lollipop.
Yum.
We've got chocolate sushi. So black garlic. So just a lot of different types of items here because people are coming up with a lot of creative things that others like.
Yeah, I think that sounds great. I think it's interesting that you're seeing the smaller sizes. That, to me, is a very interesting development.
Is that a trend that's going to continue, you think? I mean, the kind of slow food, artisanal?
Yeah, I definitely think that's a trend that's going to continue because, you know, people want to think specialty foods is doing well in this economy. You know, it's not really suffering like many other things are. And people want to treat themselves to really good food. It's kind of an affordable and indulgence. It doesn't cost a lot to have a nice, you know, mustard in your turkey sandwich or whatever. Your indulgence would be.
Right.
So people are looking at that, but they're really looking for smaller sizes. You know, they're looking for things that, you know, are a little bit more portion control. They're also very innovative, the people using specialty foods. So if they buy like a small cooking sauce, you know, they can buy that, use that, and then go out and buy another flavor because they're always looking for new things to try. So the smaller sizes lets them, you know, get different things more quickly.
That's cool. Ron, let's switch gears just for a second and talk a little bit about the international part of your job. I saw, you know, Camille was nice enough to send me your job title, and I saw that you do a lot of international, the sort of your liaison with international foods. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about sort of import and export and the difficulties there to, you know, that accrue to those kinds of efforts, and whether there are quotas that we have to reach in terms of our exports versus what we can import and what it takes to sort of set that chain up. Is that, I know it's a big question, so you can tackle any part of that you want to.
Yeah, that's a really complicated question, and it really depends on the countries. One thing that NASFT is trying to do is we're trying to export quality American foods to other countries in the world that want them. So people like American products, but, you know, we're trying to make them think America isn't just Coca-Cola and McDonald's.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're taking crackers and cheeses and, you know, pasta sauces and maple syrup and, you know, scone mixes and all these different things to parts of Europe, and particularly we've done quite well with exporting the products to Japan. So we're trying to help our members grow their businesses in other parts of the world, you know, and help those parts of the world get some more interesting foods that they can eat.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that is a really unbelievable. I mean, Ron, when Katie said that you would be on the show, I was like, we need him for two or three or four segments. And she was like, listen, this is his busy, one of his busiest days of the year. We have to have him come back. So I really hope that in a couple of weeks you could be, you know, come into the studio. We could have you out for lunch or if we need to call in. But there is a million questions that we wanted to ask. And we thank you so much for spending some time on such a busy day, the opening day of NASFT.
Okay, great. Thank you. And just let us know how we can help you again. We'd be glad
to. Well, we'll be calling you, Ron.
You're awesome, Ron. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good luck with the show.
Break a leg. All right. And we will be right back with Hugo Gonzalez. We'll be right back. If it's Sunday,
it's the main course.
I'm Patrick Martin.
And I'm Katie Kiefer. Now, this is the Heritage Radio Network, Patrick.
And today we're sponsored by TechServe, the number one Mac store in America. And we are really, really honored to have Hugo Gonzalez with us all the way from Chile. And I actually was lucky enough to meet Hugo through one of the, you know, innermost circle Heritage Foods advisors, Jeremy Hirsch.
Wow. Oh, how cool.
That's
cool.
That's quite a compliment. Thank you.
So Jeremy Hirsch is an advisor for Heritage Foods. He's a lawyer. And how did you two meet? And tell us a little bit about how you and Hugo met up.
Yeah, well, we met. I was in Colombia several months ago, and a friend of mine down in Colombia is affiliated with Hugo's company, Carnes Nuble. And I spoke about Heritage and all the good work that they do, and they thought it would be great to introduce the two companies. Hugo came a few months ago and has been working very hard, although I don't think it takes too much effort to build the to talk about Chilean beef and lamb and their products and trying to expand into the American market. And so he came up again recently, and we brought him around and introduced him to some chefs and restaurants, and they've gotten a tremendous response, and I thought it would be great to bring him on today and have him talk to you guys a little more about what they do.
Fantastic. Tell us a little bit about, before we get into Carnes Nuble in particular, tell us, what is Chilean beef? Tell us a little bit about that terroir.
So thank you very much for receiving me today. It's an honor to me too. I would say that Chile has a tremendous opportunity in beef and lamb because we have a very clear environment for our cattle and our lamb. We produce without any hormones or antibiotics and so on. Our beef and lamb are fed always by grass almost the entire life. Inside a very clean and healthy environment. I think that is the very good advantage Chile has as a country.
What causes your environment to be cleaner, say, than other great beef? Argentina also produces enormous quantities of beef. What would you say is the big qualitative difference between the two?
It's different because the Chilean government has a health policy in his government. That means Chile is the only country in South America free from foot and mouth disease without vaccination, free from BCA problems. So it's the only country because we have a natural barriers like the entire 5,000 kilometers of the Andes Mountains.
I see. So in other words, you've never been exposed to any of the, even through imports. In other words, you don't import product that would potentially infect your herds.
You're right. Because we have Andes Mountains. Excuse me, Patrick. We have the Andes Mountain for the side, and the other side is Pacific Ocean.
What about genetics? Do you mix up your genetics with other breeds? And then if you buy, the genetics from other countries, I guess you're just buying embryos or what is this proper term for?
I would say none.
Sperm.
Sperm. Yeah. Semen.
Yeah, semen. No. We have in Chile only Angus and Breton races, Breton breeds. And it's a local breed. It has been for many, many generations there. And we have mostly Angus and Hereford breeds for producing
beef cattle.
And now, because of those natural barriers, what does that mean? Does that mean you can, for instance, export foods that other countries cannot because you have never had foot and mouth or any of those things?
Yeah, of course. In fact, we can export into the States bone-in beef.
Okay.
The only other country in South America allowed to export, it's only Uruguay, but we're only boneless. Never bone-in. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Chile has also a free trade agreement with the United States. Oh. So our beef and Chilean products does not pay any taxes or duties here. We don't have any quota. Also, Chile can export to Japan market. Mm-hmm. It's a no one country in Mercosur can do that right now.
Mm-hmm. And I've always, you know, many of these local locavores, you know, they only want to eat local. And so they asked me, you know, well, why would we support Chilean beef? And I said, better grass-fed beef from Chile than commodity indoor beef raised here in America.
Yeah, I would say Chile has advantages in not only in breeds. Our beef has less quantity of fat inside the beef, so it's more healthy. It has less quantity of cholesterol, for instance, more quantity of iron. We are testing right now with the USDA here in the state our nutrition fact, and it will be ready in 2 months more.
Okay.
And we will prove that our beef is more healthy. That is a huge advantage.
Absolutely. Now, we only have a couple minutes left. I wanted to ask, where can people find more information about your company, Carnes Nuble? And tell us briefly, what is Carnes Nuble? How many head of cattle? Like, where do you sell?
Carnes Nuble is a holding company located in Chile, in Santiago. We are producing about 22,000 heads per year only in the natural beef concept. Mm-hmm. We have a program with certain producers that they are producing only for our company, and we are slaughtering about a year about 100,000 only grass-fed beef for different countries. I think shortly people in the state will find our beef calling by Heritage Food USA, and I think that is one of the strong points of our integrity.
That's good.
Yeah, we love that Heritage Foods USA.
Any other group would just be this. Yep. Heritage Foods is this.
Absolutely.
Well, this is a huge honor, and I know we're going to be working together, so I hope any Sunday that you're in America, in New York, that you can come and we give updates, and certainly you are a friend of the Heritage Radio Network, so not just this show, but other shows
as
well.
Yeah, I love the cattle industry, and I have a lot of questions for you about...
She used to be a butcher.
Yeah.
Okay.
But also, I write a lot about the cattle industry, and I've done a lot of reading about it, so I'm very interested in hearing about what your program is and how things are changing in South America, how, you know, what's happening there that's sort of complementary to what's happening here. So thank mm-hmm. you so much for coming, and you must come back.
And do you have a website?
Carnesnuble.cl.
What's that?
Carnes.cl. CARNES.cL.
CCL.
CL.
Chile. Oh, okay, great.
Yeah. Chile.
Yeah.
Great,
yeah.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, both of you, for coming on, and we'll see you again very soon.
And you can see a bunch of restaurants carrying that beef very soon.
Maybe we'll put that up on the website.
Yes, absolutely.
We're back.
If it's Sunday.
It's the main course, Patrick.
I'm Patrick Martins. That's Katie Kiefer.
And we are the Heritage Radio Network, sponsored today by TechServe.
We're doing a show all on fancy food or, you know, specialty food, but this is a show dedicated to fancy food. And our next guest is some friends of yours from the awesome Rogue Creamery.
The awesome Rogue Creamery in Oregon. This is David. Are you there?
I am, Katie and Patrick. It's great to be with you today.
Thank you so much for joining us. It's like really exciting and busy for you. It's always a big deal when you first open your booth. And I think the show just started like an hour or two ago, right?
It did. And it's robust. The aisles are filled. It's really a great showing. There's buyers from all over the world.
In your honor, I'm wearing Ann Saxelby's craft cheese shirt. She's a cheesemaker here. I was so happy for you to be on. So tell us a little bit about where your stand is at the Fancy Food Show. Who's next to you? Give us a feel.
My stand here at the NASFT Food Show is on the main floor, and I'm surrounded by a number of cheesemakers from America. And it's just really great. So next to me here is Cypress Grove from Humboldt County. And
fantastic.
Then on the other side is Vermont Butter and Cheese.
Allison Hooper.
Oh.
Yeah, Allison. And so, and then we have Grafton, also from Vermont.
From Vermont, yeah.
And we have Amablue from Minnesota. So there's a great, great showing of American artisan and farmstead cheesemakers here at the Fancy Food Show.
So, Dave, tell us a little bit about one thing that I was really curious about was cheese prices, especially for American artisanal cheese, have like doubled and tripled in the last year and a half. What's the deal with that?
You know, it's interesting, Katie. It's really been a very complex and challenging few years, both on the producer side and the processor side. The producer side being the fluid milk side.
Uh-huh.
You know, we've all experienced the increase of certainly fuel prices. We've seen that at the pumps, and certainly that's impacted grain prices and hay prices, and it's just the cost of doing business on the farm and maintaining the environments that we do there, being stewards of the land and having our compassionate programs for our animals, and certainly offering livable wages and benefits for our team members has really been difficult and challenging because, one, the cost of feed is so high, and two, our overhead is high, but the cost of milk now has dropped so much. But, you know, our costs are the same, so we have the challenges there. So our biggest input is fluid milk, and for those who don't know, it's a 10-to-1 ratio. So basically, for every 10 pounds of milk, you're getting 1 pound of cheese. So you can imagine how that cost affects cheese.
Isn't dairy, I always thought that dairy was subsidized by the government. And so maybe you can explain how
bottom
of the milk world fell out.
Certainly, there is a federal milk order that publishes milk prices on a monthly basis, and that's what the industry follows. But for farmstead and artisan cheesemakers, you know, we have our own relationship between our dairy and our creamery. So we set our own prices, and those prices are based on the actual real cost of doing business. It's just the reality of making cheese as an American cheesemaker. Our costs are higher in America, based on everything from humanitarian care of our herd, the care of the land, and offering livable wages,
now,
and then
Are the people in Oregon, now it's one of my favorite areas of the country in terms of its climate and the foods produced there and the people there, how much of your production is sold within the state of Oregon and how much is sold?
You know, I have to say the Pacific Northwest is very supportive of Oregon cheesemakers and certainly Washington cheesemakers. The whole Pacific Northwest embraces its makers, producers, and growers, and so about 80% of our business is in our own backyard. So,
like that makes
most
it very local.
Farmstead and artisan producers, we have multiple channels of distribution. We have a small farm store at our creamery, and we have a farmers market network. We do 3 farmers markets locally in the Rogue Valley, and then we do 5 in the Portland area. And so there's also 14 other makers of cheese in Oregon that operate very similarly as Rogue Creamery. And then we have wholesale distributors that will distribute to restaurants and mm-hmm. specialty food and natural food stores.
Who are you trying to meet? What is the objective of your presence at the Fancy Food Show? Like, what's the best that could happen? I mean, why do you come to New York to do this show?
The objective is to increase awareness around artisan and farmstead cheese made in the Pacific Northwest. And certainly to place our blue in finer dining and gourmet food stores and natural food stores. And it's for us, we're very conscious of the placement of our blue cheese in the right environment that the cheesemonger or the chef can communicate the story. We work so hard in making our blue that we really want to connect to those who can tell our story.
And really appreciate what you're doing out there.
Well, thank you so much. I mean, I really hope this is not your last time on the network. Maybe in a few weeks you can come back when you're not so busy. And, you know, we would really love to learn more from you and have you be a big part of our network. So thank you so much for taking time.
That would be fantastic. No, certainly we'd love to increase our presence here in the city and outlying areas, and certainly would love to talk to you in the future more about not only what's happening in Oregon, but certainly in the Americas. There's a renaissance in farmstead and artisan cheese making. It's exciting, and it really, really...
it's going to take off.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if you could hear that. Well, no.
I did.
Good,
that was hilarious.
Good. It's awesome.
Cheese wheels just rolling out of your refrigerator.
That's right.
Absolutely. Well, listen, you've been great,
Dave,
and we will have
pleasure.
You on very
Rogue
soon again.
Rogue Creamery, please look for it in your local restaurants. I know you guys are selling here in New York, so.
We are. We sell at Murray's Artisanal Fairway Market.
Great.
Whole Foods and a number of fine dining restaurants in the city. So thank you.
Thank you
okay,
so
we'll
much
talk
for being
celebrating American artisan and farmstead cheese.
You all betcha. The time.
All right, Dave. Bye-bye.
Here we are. If it's Sunday,
it's the main course.
Yes, it is. This is Patrick Martins.
I'm Katie Kiefer.
We're talking all about fancy food, and our next guest is Rick from Rick's Picks. Rick, are you on with us? Rick.
Yes, hello.
How are you?
I'm good. It's very exciting here at the Fancy Food Show. Tons of people.
Tell us, what do you see from where you're standing?
Right where I'm standing, I'm looking at an escalator because I had to step off the floor because it was so loud on the floor.
Yeah.
But I'm peering back in, and actually, we're in the New York Pavilion.
Okay.
So I'm looking down the aisle at all the local New York artists and producers, and it's a really nice group.
Fantastic. And tell me, what is at your stand? If someone were, what's your stand number? And if someone were to come to your stand, what would they see?
Well, our booth number 5417, and we changed up our display this year a little bit. We wanted to sort of invite people in instead of having a big wall in the front like we normally do with all the jars displayed. So we've created this sort of like a living room environment where you can come in and try all of our pickles. We have a new pickle that we're sampling, which is called the People's Pickle, that we're very excited about. It's a chunky, garlicky slice. It's a sort of a Jewish deli-style pickle. And, you know, people have been asking us for years, you know, at farmers markets where we, you know, we see people every week to do, you know, something that would be more along the lines of a New York deli-style pickle. And so this year we've kind of come up with it. And it's also... has a simpler recipe than some of our other pickles, which are kind of on the esoteric side, and so as a result, it has a lower retail price. So we think it's kind of lined up nicely with the economic moment that we're all going through right now.
Uh-huh. Absolutely. So, but tell us about your more esoteric pickles. Like, what other vegetables are you pickling, and how much of it do you see a big trend in pickle eating? Because I notice a lot more people are canning than used to.
Right. Well, you know, I think okay. First of all, what vegetables do we pickle? We basically pickle 13 different kinds of things. We do okra, we do beets, we do green tomatoes, we do green beans, we do asparagus. If I have anything to say about it, we're going to do some Brussels sprouts later on this year.
Nice.
We're doing some relishes. We're doing a corn relish called Handy Corn that's actually nominated for a Fancy Food Show Award this year.
Fantastic.
And also another pickle that we have called Smoker, which is our pickled okra, is also a finalist, a nominee for Fancy Food Show Award this year. So that's
congratulations.
And as far as, you know, what you were saying about the trend for home canning, you know, I think it's absolutely true. And I mean, I think it extends across the entire universe of crafts. You know, everything from knitting, making, you know, things that you can do at home, you know, with your hands and a tangible result, I think is very satisfying. Because I think one of the things you can say for sure about, you know, the 21st century is, it's great that we have the internet. It's great that we can communicate in all these ways. But there's also something that's kind of sort of isolating and discombobulating about all that stuff. And I think that connecting, you know, to the time-honored traditions of home canning, you know, is something that people sort of really are excited to do now.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, we're sort of overwhelmed by so much technology. And, you know, if you ask around, you'll find almost everybody's got a story about their grandmother or their uncle or their family pickle recipe. And, you know, the line I always like to say is, it doesn't really matter whether you're talking about Japan, Poland, Louisiana, New Jersey. There's every culture has some form of pickling in it. And I think that, you know, you're seeing people wanting to continue these time-honored trends.
Absolutely. Now, we know how busy you are, and you have a million people in your stand. Tell us real quickly, until you're on next time, which will hopefully be in the next few weeks, we would love to have you back on as soon as you can make it. Where can people find your pickles or buy your pickles if they don't go to the Fancy Food Show?
Okay, well, our website is rickspicksnyc.com, rickspicksnyc.com. That's where you're always going to find the widest selection. You can also find us at farmers markets in New York. We do Union Square Wednesdays and Saturdays, and soon we'll be there Fridays. We do Grand Army Plaza, Brooklyn. We do Fort Greene, Brooklyn. We're going to do Stuytown in the fall. We're also at the Brooklyn Flea. We're at the Brooklyn Flea today, underneath the Brooklyn Bridge, and also on Saturdays in Fort Greene. And we're sold in stores. We're in a variety of stores. We're in all the Whole Foods. and, you know, a variety of specialty stores, Murray's Cheese, Manhattan Fruit Exchange, Dean and DeLuca, places like that.
Fantastic. Well, Rick, best of luck at your stand, and I can't wait to have you in studio when we can hang out a little bit and do three or four segments together.
Maybe we could get some recipes from you to put on the website.
We should make some pickles on the radio.
I think we should, too.
Yeah, that's what I want.
I'll see you on Monday, because I'm going to be out there tomorrow.
Thank you so much, Rick. We'll talk soon.
Thanks a lot. Cheers.
Bye-bye. Oh my God, it's Sunday.
And that means it's the main course.
I'm Katie Kiefer.
I'm Patrick Martins.
This is Heritage Radio Network, and we are sponsored today by TechServe.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we have Fritzi Cohen in the studio with us today. Patrick, why don't you start off with Fritzi, because you know her so well.
Well, I think I should call Nat Wiener in, our engineer, because it's his aunt, the content maven, that I think first introduced me to Fritzi. Thanks, Nat.
Thank you, Nat.
Oh, I got the thumbs up. He said, no problem. So Fritzi is, first of all, I'm a big fan of your daughter and her potato chip company. I can't wait to hear about that. But also, you have the most lovely place right within throwing distance of the White House, right?
Exactly.
Is that
Hotel Tabard Inn.
Hotel Tabard Inn. So I don't know quite how to, you're an activist. We were trying to describe what you do, but you have two places. One's the Tabard Inn, then you have another place called Moby Dick.
The Moby Dick Hotel and Oyster Farm in Washington State on once pristine Willapa Bay.
Fantastic. Well, that's going to be the big part of our second segment about all the oysters and everything that's been happening. You're a big activist down there. But tell us a little bit. I mean, what have you done? How did you get there? And
well, first of all, I am the matriarch of the Tabard Inn, and I'm associated deeply with Route 11 potato chips, and that's why I'm in New York at the Fancy Food Show. And we're in the Virginia, state of Virginia area.
As is Sam.
Yes, that's right. Downstairs, as they say, 5300. And so basically, I'm in a lot of different businesses. And how did I get out to Washington State?
And into the oyster business?
And into the oyster business. Well,
are there oysters in D.C.?
Well, not growing there.
Not anymore. I think there were a lot of oysters in the Chesapeake Bay area,
Lots of oysters. But actually, my husband and I were looking for a place to go and be consultants, you know, go and advise people on hotel restoration. Since we were really, the Tabard was one of the first boutique hotels in the United States. It was, you know, and we kept it alive, actually. It had been scheduled to be for demolition.
Wow.
And when the people who had a contract to purchase it conditioned on demolition lost, we stepped in and saved a wonderful place. So, but I've always loved oysters. My father was from Greenville, Mississippi, and was a big oyster fan. And I grew up in Wisconsin. Somehow, I loved oysters. So we went out to, we were looking at some projects in Washington State, and we ended up going to Willapa Bay and going past South Bend, where it said, you know, the world's capital of oysters. So we just basically...
You dropped anchor there.
Dropped an anchor, you know, and it was in some ways very serendipitous.
Where is Willapa Bay exactly?
Willapa Bay is in the southwestern corner of Washington State, right? There's a peninsula. I'm on a peninsula called the Long Beach Peninsula, and it is at the mouth of the Columbia River.
Oh.
And it goes up for 25 miles. So I'm in Nakata, Washington, and where I am, I'm on the Moby Dick is on Willapa Bay, and we're a mile from the Pacific Ocean.
Now I know why you have that email address.
Yes.
And before we get to the whole very important issues that we want to bring up, tell us a bit about Route 11 and your daughter. I mean, we are lucky enough to sell her chips on our website. It's the only heritage chip, of course.
Well, and it is. It deserves to be.
Yes.
Sarah has been, you know, making, she really took and the chip operation and ran with it. In fact, she ran away from Middletown, Virginia, and Marcia told me to make a plug if anyone is interested in the old factory. It's a great place for good bread. And if somebody wants to move to Virginia. But anyway, Sarah has a new state-of-the-art factory in Mount Jackson, and she makes what I believe is one of the best potato chips that I've ever tasted.
And it doesn't, I mean, like, she's even concerned about, like, shipping it long distances because it doesn't travel that well on the
plane.
Well,
she's trying, you know, as a business person, she's trying to figure it out. Actually, Dean and DeLuca took her chips to Kuwait.
Wow.
At one point. And so.
What makes her chips different and special?
Well, they're kettle cooked.
But lots of people say their chips are kettle cooked.
It's the ingredients that
It's not a continuous cooker. And her
so
ingredient.
It's
and it's batched, yes. And in the old factory, there was somebody with a rake that would actually turn the chips.
Wow.
And now I think in the new factory they have state-of-the-art equipment. It actually, I don't think there's a person that rakes, moves it around, but it turns. And it really, it's really very interesting because the quality of the chip has actually improved with the new equipment. And, you know, there are lots of things that happen. You know, every raw ingredient has gone way up in price. And she used to make the best root vegetable mix. I don't know if you remember that, but she had to really stop it because of the cost of the raw materials.
And she was buying farm-raised, not commodity-raised root vegetables, but farm-raised, you know, individual.
Well, you have to talk to Sarah about, because I really am.
Well, I'm just wondering,
you know,
what the heritage part of it is.
Well, I mean, the heritage, there were a couple of chips that she was the only one
sweet
using
potatoes.
Those.
Sweet,
was an arc potato.
And that was the Hayman.
Right.
And the Hayman potato is a root that is indigenous to the Eastern Shore. Mm-hmm. And she still makes those, but they're seasonal.
Right.
And you know what happens when you have a seasonal product, though. It confuses retailers.
I know.
Oh,
they're like, what? We have
to
explain something to our workers?
And I mean, it's really, I mean, this is one of the things I find so interesting. And also, potatoes themselves are vegetables. Mm-hmm. So one of the problems now is that the potato season starts in Florida. Well, when there's a lot of rain in Florida, that can create havoc in the potato market. But also the other thing that's happening is that a lot of the agricultural land is being developed into mm-hmm. housing. Her potato farmer in North Carolina, she had a wonderful organic potato farmer who felt that the seed potatoes were getting so expensive that this year he's not growing them. I mean, agriculture is a mobile thing, and it's really hard to be a farmer.
Absolutely. We're going to go to agriculture to aquaculture in our next segment, but I will say also those potato chips have the coolest designed bags.
Exactly. I have to say, if anyone is going to the food show, Sarah's friend Jane is wearing a dress made out of Route 11 packaging.
Potato chip packages? Oh, wow.
I love that repurposed bag.
Eat your heart out, other ladies, because she's wearing an edible. Well, fantastic. So we're
the dress is not edible.
Oh, it's not.
But it's recycled.
It's recycled bags.
Very important.
Very cool.
Okay, well, we'll take a 30-second break and be back with Fritzy Cohen.
Back. It's Sunday, and that means
the main course.
This is Katie Kiefer, and you're Patrick Martins.
Yes.
And this is the Heritage Radio Network, sponsored today in this hour by TechServe.
TechServe Macintosh.
And we're doing all things fancy food today, and we have with us in the studio Fritzy Cohen, who is the matriarch of the Tabard Inn.
Nicest place in D.C.
The mother of Route 11 potato chips.
And
Sarah Cohen.
And an activist on oysters.
And a very much an environmental activist.
What's the situation there? What's pissing you off? Why should we all be pissed off? And how are we going to fix it?
All right. Well, first of all, I had a...
Nicely put, Patrick.
I have what I call a bittersweet victory. When a judge said that I had been deprived of my due process rights by the arbitrary and capricious actions of Pacific County because they were trying to force pesticides on my oyster beds.
Mm. And why were they trying to do that?
Well, because they don't like Spartina grass. And in 1990, Monsanto and the Nature Conservancy and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service decided that because this Spartina grass, which is beloved on the Eastern Gulf Coast, which is a barometer of the health of an ecosystem, was non-native and it had been there 100 years, but they despised it. They've demonized it on the whole West Coast. And the problem with it is that in demonizing it, they've also opened the door to, and this was their motive, I'm sure, to spraying with pesticides. And so for the commercial oystermen are lousy stewards. And you know of Taylor Industries.
Sure.
Yeah.
And I learned about them through you.
That's right. And Taylor, you know, what makes me angry at Taylor is he's powerful enough is that he could say, hey, guys, we're not going to do this. This is bad for the environment. But he doesn't.
For profit.
For profit. And so the thing is that the commercial oystermen in Willapa Bay have been spraying, and perhaps even in the parts of Puget Sound, they've been spraying carbaryl, which is a very bad chemical, since 1965.
I just did a sound effect of like the evil industry.
The crow.
And if you look it up online, you'll see how ridiculously terrible it is. And then since 1990, they've been spraying glyphosate or rodeo, and now they have a cocktail of glyphosate and imazapyr that they've been spraying, and I've been fighting it for 18 years. And there's, you know, it's really important about to know about oysters. First of all, an oyster needs to be really good and edible and safe, it needs to be in an environment that where the water quality is high. And one of the things is it takes a lot of crap to kill an oyster. And so now there are people, for instance, I was at a conference in New York Harbor. They are growing reefs to clean up the area, because this area used to be enormously, well, a long time ago when the Dutch came, they came to Manhattan, New Amsterdam, because one of the reasons was is that they had already over-harvested oysters in Europe, and there were oysters.
Yes, all along the Connecticut shore and all
everywhere.
Along the New York
coastline. And they were not in they weren't food for the elitists. They were, you know, people would just go and pick
it
them up.
It was street food.
It was street food. So anyway, When we bought the Moby Dick, my husband said that I would have a lifetime supply of oysters. And so we were just on the brink of marketing our very special oysters to Portland when my oyster beds were drifted on by the chemicals. And so, you know, being a person that wants to protect my rights and also doesn't like pesticides, I'm just very in a lot of litigation in Washington State. But what I want to say is that I noticed that, for instance, I was at a restaurant in very fancy restaurant in New York, and whenever I see Washington State oysters on the menu, I have a conversation.
Mm-hmm. You're
with
like,
them.
Whose are they?
Well, whose are they? And actually, I think there is more and more awareness of what's going on. I'm not saying that all parts of Washington State are bad, but I will say that I wouldn't eat an oyster out of Willapa Bay, or I would not eat a clam out of Willapa Bay.
And yet this is your home place. This is where you have been working so hard to be a steward of the land.
Well, that's right. And I'm one of the only, you know, it's a very strange sort of political situation. And it's all about politics, mm-hmm. not about science. But I have to tell you, the thing that is interesting, because I think in New York and on the East Coast, people don't understand why there is this fixation and obsession about spartina grass. But on the West Coast, when the West Coast governors from California, Oregon, and Washington State have a proposal to save the ocean, wouldn't you believe it? But they have, out of 10 maybe things they're going to do, one is spartina eradication.
Why do they want that, though, to play devil's advocate?
Well, they start by saying it's non-native, and then they'll say that it's invasive.
Meaning it kills oysters?
No.
Or it
no,
kills
no.
other forms of plant life
it might,
on
it,
your coast?
Well, that's what they say, but I think, you know, when you want to do something, you can make up a lot of things about it that will allow you then to spray pesticides on it.
You don't often hear the Nature Conservancy and the National Marine Fisheries Services in the same breath.
It isn't. National Marine Fisheries is a separate thing. It's the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Oh, sorry. But you don't often hear those two organizations in the same sentence with Monsanto. And I you know,
well, actually,
I think it's kind of an interesting unification there.
Well, yes, Monsanto gave, well, first of all, one of the interesting things about the Nature Conservancy is that the Henry Paulson, you know, remember him?
Yeah.
The guy that brought us this economic wreckage?
Absolutely.
Yeah, he was the president of the Nature Conservancy. And when he became Secretary of the Treasury, he resigned, but then the next person at Goldman Sachs became the president of the Nature Conservancy. And they have a very close relationship with Monsanto, apparently, because Monsanto gave them $1.5 million to preserve, save some estuary, not estuaries, riverbanks or whatever.
$1.5 million is not a lot of money in the grand scheme of things.
Well, in
though,
the grand
when you're
scheme
about
of
saving,
things, it
isn't.
But, you know, the point is when Monsanto gives money, probably, and the Nature Conservancy is very active in Willapa Bay in spraying pesticides and in supporting the use of pesticides to kill vegetation that is in the water, basically.
Actually, we only have 30 seconds left. What, give us in 20 seconds the hope, and then I have a question, personal question
All
about
right.
oysters.
The hope is that they'll stop using pesticides aquatically in Willapa Bay.
Are you getting anywhere with that? Is there a petition we can sign
well,
or a website?
Well, I have a petition that I can send you, but also...
is there a website?
There is a website, the Moby Dick Hotel, www.mobydickhotel.com, and you will learn more about our situation. My feeling is if you have friends in Washington State who don't like pesticides, have them get in touch with me, please.
Okay, fantastic. And last question, I always order West Coast oysters, no matter where I am in the United States, because I like them more. They're brinier, as long as they're not from Willapa Bay. Is that okay? Are locals supposed to be only eaten locally?
Personally, you know, at the Tabard Inn, we eat Rhode Island. There's some wonderful oysters on the East Coast. And
right.
That, by the way, is a new development because
right,
in Rhode
Fritzy.
Island, where I grew up, we couldn't eat oysters for about 15 or 20 years because the oyster beds had been so polluted. So
well,
that's,
this
that's
has
a
been
nice
a fan. Fantastic show. Fritzy,
fantastic.
Thank you so much for coming on. I'm sorry to drag you all the way out to Brooklyn.
How do I get back?
Don't worry. We'll give you a knife and a gun to make it all the way back from Bushwick.
Yeah.
There are cab services and stuff like that. Or Sam will go back with you, your fellow Virginian standmate. But Katie, great show. I actually kind of liked having this many guests, although I think in the future we need fewer guests for longer periods of time. Once every... few
months. But every once in a while, it's great to have a big smorgasbord, just like the Fancy Food Show.
I thought this
was a lot of fun today, and thanks, Patrick, for going along with all of our wild ideas.
No,
here.
It's awesome. This is so exciting. Katie, this show would be nothing without you. We all know it. And then we are very psyched, and we have, we're taking the 4th off, and then
we'll be back July 10th,
July,
11th,
it's after
like
the 4th.
Yeah.
It's the 5th
on. The
next
weekend.
But, yeah, we're going to have a really good theme that we'll decide the day before.
That's right.
All right, Katie.
This has been the main course.
It's
Thank
Sunday.
You very much.
One of the things... Για σε μη μου αμάν, αμάν να σε το για σε μη μου σου κι από τσανθού σου να φορώ κι από τσανθού σου να φορώ λάσπρη την αυλή μου Thank you.
πες σαν ηλιακτίδα του χιόνια. Σαν ηλιακτίδα του χιόνια το βλέμμα σου προβαίνει. Αμάν, αμάν, το βλέμμα σου προβαίνει. Στη μαργωμένη μου καρδιά